gone are the days when we turned up the FiO2 and the patient was 100 post cardiac arrest and we were happy with that.
Slightly perplexed by the large differences in number randomized to the different group.
Welcome everyone to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. So happy that you're joining us for this podcast. This is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, and I have a question. Let's just say you are working your next shift and you get a box call, EMS call, of a 56-year-old gentleman coming in cardiac arrest. This was a witness arrest at home, bystander CPR applied, EMS arrival, and the initial rhythm is a shockable rhythm. He is defibrillated, but unsuccessfully at home, placed in the EMS unit and driven to your emergency department. So they radio en route that they are inbound just a few minutes away with this ongoing cardiac arrest, receiving mechanical CPR, a supraglottic airway in place, receiving BVM with 100% FiO2 and IO has been placed, got a few rounds of medicines. They're 2 minutes from the door. You prep your team. The patient rolls in, and as they're arriving, they state they were successful in one last attempt at defibrillation. They have achieved return of spontaneous circulation. So the patient arrives with a perfusing pulse, starting to regain signs of perfusion, has a reasonable blood pressure, and now we need to talk about some post-arrest interventions. So we're going to leave that there. Think about that case. Undoubtedly, it's something you have had probably recently, if not will be, before we end 2026 here. And before jumping into the details of what we're going to cover this podcast, let me bring in my absolutely stellar, amazing co-host here on CCPEM, Dr. John Greenwood, Dr. Peter W., and Dr. Rob Rodriguez. John, I'm starting with you first. It's been a few weeks since we've had a chance to gather, do another recording. How has the summer been for you?
Summer has been great. Not a lot of vacation time, just a few long weekends, which has been fun with the family. But I was really excited when you sent this trial over because this still is the beginning of the year, which is always an exciting time to talk about what could be a better critical care or emergency medicine topic than cardiac arrest. This will definitely impact a lot of people as they're figuring out what their practice is, whether you're interns or early residents, and hopefully provide some fodder for discussion.
Awesome. Well, I'm already excited to jump into the topic, but Dr. W., how goes it in New Orleans?
Well, it's still pretty hot here in New Orleans. And there's not much because of the time of year from a festival standpoint, which is a little slow period of time for us because of the heat and humidity. But we're looking forward to a wonderful September and back into festival season.
I am confident there are wonderful plans for many and a numerous festival in the New Orleans region.
Yeah. To include the Funk Festival.
Well, in a subsequent episode, we'll get you to update everybody on what that is. I'll look forward to hearing that. All right, let's turn west, pivot out to Dr. Rodriguez. How is it in California?
It is in a three-letter word, hot. It's been crazy hot over the past month with little sign of relief. We've had a so-called heat dome over Southern California for going on 40 days now. And even for a native border Texan, it's been pretty hot out here.
Lots of impressive weather heat waves this particular summer. Probably undoubtedly where any of our listeners are, they've experienced something from an oppressive heat, for sure.
For those who don't believe in a climate change, I think last year was, again, another hottest year on record. And it's hard to argue against that type of data.
Well said. And well, with that, Dr. Rodriguez, let's pivot back to our clinical topic. Dr. Greenwood, you started off by saying cardiac arrest care. I think we love to talk about that. Our listeners, you all know that we love to talk about cardiac arrest care, but let's hit this particular 56-year-old. Now we're in a post-arrest care state. And as you've heard us talk about before, just thinking about big topics with post-arrest care, optimizing oxygenation, ventilation, hemodynamics, thinking about potential seizures in the unresponsive patient or persistently comatose patient, and getting an early EEG. We've talked about temperature control and then post-arrest cardiac catheterization for applicable patients. Let's kind of focus in on that first topic I mentioned, and that is optimizing oxygenation. And the reason we're talking about that is because, as we've done, we like to hit hot off the press articles here. And one was just published actually just a few weeks ago, New England Journal of Medicine, pertaining to oxygen concentration in cardiac arrest. It was performed by the Logical Investigators and the Australian and New Zealand Intensive Care Society Clinical Trials Group. And the title of the paper was Conservative Oxygen for Unresponsive Patients After Cardiac Arrest. Dr. Greenwood, set the stage for this particular trial. What are we going to discuss over the course of the rest of this podcast?
Absolutely, Mike. So, what we do know in emergency medicine is there are a few time-sensitive interventions that can really make a huge impact in these critically ill patients. And simple things like making decisions about prescriptions of oxygen or blood pressure or fluid resuscitation strategies and endpoints are really, really important. So, in this patient and in this randomized control trial that was just published, it tackled a really important question about the prescription of oxygen in patients post-cardiac arrest. And the reason why this is an important question is because brain damage and death from ischemic encephalopathy is really common after cardiac arrest. And it can be the result of both oxygen deprivation during the arrest and some cases too much oxygen after return of spontaneous circulation. And there is a body of literature that has led up to these randomized clinical trials that started out in some animal studies that showed high oxygen exposure after return of spontaneous circulation may result in brain cell injury and death. And that was followed by a number of observational studies. And I think the biggest ones came actually out of Cooper, right across the Delaware River from me. Hope Kilgannon and Brian Roberts both published studies that looked at hyperoxia after cardiac arrest. And Hope Kilgannon showed that the relationship wasn't just like a threshold, but actually continuous. So the higher the oxygen level was and the PO2 was, the increased risk of mortality and brain injury that occurred. And as I was kind of reviewing some of the previous literature, this was replicated in an even larger 12,000 patient study in the ANZICS group by Rinaldo Bellomo, who unfortunately just passed away, but has left an indelible mark on the resuscitation literature. But nonetheless, these studies have really driven some important clinical decisions about what should we be doing with our FiO2 prescription after arrest. And so the hypothesis has been that maybe limiting oxygen exposure or a conservative oxygen strategy may reduce reperfusion injury and improve clinical outcomes. So we talked a little about the observational literature, but there are two trials in patients with cardiac arrests in the ICU that suggest a benefit with a conservative approach to oxygen treatment. And in contrast, a trial of cardiac arrest patients in Denmark showed no difference in outcomes between a conservative and liberal oxygen strategy. You might remember we talked about that a little while ago, called the BOX trial. And so, given the mixed results of the current literature, the low oxygen intervention for cardiac arrest injury limitation, or the logical trial, was performed. And so the investigators here really wanted to test the hypothesis that conservative oxygen therapy improves survival with favorable functional outcome at a longer outcome at 180 days compared to liberal oxygen therapy in adult patients following cardiac arrests who had been admitted to the ICU and suspected to have ischemic encephalopathy.
Really great setting the table, John, for us. Awesome background information with respect to now the objective of this particular trial. Dr. Rodriguez, Rob, I'm kicking this over to you. Let's go through the methods so we have an understanding of what the investigator set out to do, and then we'll turn to Peter to bring us home with the results.
Sounds good. This was an investigator-initiated open label parallel group, assessor blinded randomized controlled trial conducted in 53 intensive care units in Australia, New Zealand, and Ireland. They included adults who were greater than 18 years of age, who were receiving mechanical ventilation in the ICU after cardiac arrest, and suspected to have ischemic encephalopathy. In other words, they were unable to follow verbal commands. They excluded patients in whom death was deemed to be imminent and inevitable. And a little bit more vague exclusion was patients in whom enrollment was not considered to be in their best interest. Again, that's a little bit of a vague exclusion criterion. In terms of randomization, enrollment was required within the first 12 hours of meeting eligibility criteria, and they were randomized 1-to-1 to conservative oxygen therapy or liberal oxygen therapy. In both groups, the acceptable lower limit for SpO2 was 90%. With regard to the conservative oxygen therapy group, FiO2 was decreased to an FiO2 of 21%, and supplemental oxygen was DC'd in patients who had been extubated if their oxygenation saturation was greater than 90%. In contrast, that with the liberal oxygen therapy group, there were no specific measures limiting the upper SpO2, but the minimum FiO2 permitted during mechanical ventilation was 30%. Other treatments were at the discretion of the treating clinician, though reducing PEEP to meet oxygen targets was discouraged. With regard to primary outcome, this was favorable functional outcome measured with the extended Glasgow outcome scale, the GOS-E-E, at 180 days. Secondary outcomes were all cause and cause-specific mortality at day 180, duration of survival to final follow-up, quality of life at 180 days, duration of mechanical ventilation, ICU and hospital length of stay, and discharge to home. They also had pre-specified subgroup analyses that included location of cardiac arrest, out of hospital versus in hospital. That was a binary pre-specified subgroup. Initial rhythm analysis, being PEA versus shockable rhythm. And then finally, the other subgroup analysis was cause of cardiac arrest, which could be medical trauma or other types of cause of cardiac arrest. So this really was a pretty broad group of patients with not just medical cardiac arrest, but a variety of causes of cardiac arrest.
Really, really helpful, Rob, and drawing the contrast between those randomized to conservative oxygen therapy where it was really kept minimal and saturations just between 90 to 95% versus liberal had that while the lower threshold was still 90%, a minimum of 30% oxygen on FiO2 and with that 180 day outcome and the secondary outcomes as you described. So with that, with setting the background, understanding what the trial methods were, Peter, you got to give us the results. Should we be providing more conservative versus liberal oxygen therapy in our post-arrest patients?
Well, over 1,800 patients were enrolled. The conservative oxygen therapy group had 882 patients, and the liberal oxygen therapy group, 958. From a baseline characteristics, they were similar in both of these groups. Mean age 60, men represented 71%, women 29%. Out of hospital cardiac arrest was 74%. Witnessed arrest 79, bystander CPR 78%. When we talk about shockable rhythms, 51%. The median time from ROSC to randomization was a little long here. It was 7 hours. So when we compare it to other studies, it's a little bit long before they get enrolled. When we talk about interventions, I'll just point out a few of them. The median percentage of hours per patient with a SAT greater than 97% in the conservative group, that wound up being 21 hours. And in the liberal oxygen group, it was 53 hours. So a little bit less than half for the conservative group. At least one PaO2 recording less than the 60 was 43.4% in the conservative group and 27.5% in the liberal oxygen group. A little surprising. And then when we talk about median percentage of hours per patient with an FiO2 at 21%, in the conservative group, that wound up being 38.8 hours and 0 hours in the liberal group. So I thought that was good. When we talk about protocol deviations, the conservative oxygen therapy group, 26.3%, and that number was only 8.4% in the liberal oxygen therapy group. So that's a big difference between the two when we talk about deviations. The primary outcome, a favorable functional outcome using the GCSE score, conservative oxygen therapy group 38.2, the liberal oxygen therapy group 39.7. So not a difference. Secondary outcomes, no difference between the groups in any of the secondary outcomes. The safety outcomes, no adverse events were reported.
Very interesting, very helpful, Peter. I guess we'll find out in our discussion whether it's significant or not in terms of really no difference between conservative versus liberal oxygen therapy. And let me just hit a few limitations that some of the authors point out and others that have looked at this particular study. You've already hit on several of these. With respect to clinicians and staff, not surprisingly, unblinded, they knew staff assignments by titrating FiO2. As Peter, you reviewed the results a little bit more. Patients were in the liberal than in the conservative oxygen therapy group. And probably one of the more pertinent ones, as you've highlighted, Peter, really a significant percentage of protocol deviations in that conservative oxygen therapy group. And that most often was a failure to reduce the FiO2 when saturations got above their upper limit of 90, 95%. In terms of the randomization, Peter, you nailed it in terms of a little bit long from ROSC all the way up to randomization of 7 hours. And just to add a little bit more detail, they actually didn't report on after they were randomized how long it took to actually apply, whether it be liberal or conservative oxygen therapy. And then I think that something that we always talk about, depending on where in the world these particular studies are performed, is the population of those 53 ICUs in Australia, New Zealand, and Ireland generalizable to the patients we see at our institutions, and then what our listeners see at their respective institutions. And so at the end of the day, what the logical trial demonstrates or is reports is that conservative oxygen therapy didn't really change, didn't improve functional outcome at that 180-day mark in adult ICU patients who remained unresponsive following cardiac arrest. So with that, Peter, I'm going to circle back to you first, for just discussion, thoughts on how we now incorporate this latest evidence on a topic that's super common to both EM and critical care with respect to oxygen levels in the post-arrest patient.
Sure, Mike, and so thanks. And so I'm not surprised by this study because our usual care, what they label as liberal, is actually usual care. And so that usual care is not hyperoxia. Gone are the days when we turned up the FiO2 and the patient was 100 post cardiac arrest, and we were happy with that, that we thought that that was the standard or that was typical or usual care. That's been kicked to the curb now, well over a decade and a half. And so the migration of using lower FiO2s really prevents what I would consider hyperoxia and further injury, let alone impact outcomes, right? And so I'm not shocked by this study. And I'm also not shocked by our colleagues in Australia, Ireland, and New Zealand who are with the same program that we are in the States, that we're not shooting for 100% saturations in our post-arrest patients. And we're not in a twist over whether it's 21% or whether it's, 24% or 30%, and that we're shooting for sats that aren't 100%.
I'd love those comments. Rob, building on what Peter just said, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Peter's spot on. That's the main take-home point, is that we've all been educated to not deliver hyperoxia anymore. I think that this study reflects that fact, both in terms of their oxygenation delivery in the usual care group and in terms of the actual SAO2s that they wound up having. The study is obviously very, very well done. It's a huge trial, a lot of effort. A little slightly perplexed by the large differences in number randomized to the different groups. They have basically 75 more patients randomized to the liberal oxygen group than the conservative oxygen group, which is basically 9% more or less of either of the group. That's pretty hard to do in a one-to-one randomization. So that's a little puzzling. But again, the main point is what Peter said. This paper is not an excuse to return to the days of hyperoxia, but we don't need to necessarily fiddle with the oxygen saturation to get tight control.
I like what you just said there, Rob. Not a days to return to hyperoxia. Well said there. All right, John. Bring this together, bring us home, some final comments, and then we'll wrap this podcast up.
So, three things that strike me of when we went through all this data about the trial. The first is I think the number of protocol deviations here is not an insignificant thing, and it is reflective of how difficult it is to do these trials in sick patients where you're taking data minute by minute, hour by hour, and trying to control it so precisely. It can be really difficult, and that I think is reflective of the work that we do every day, right? The second thing, and this is probably the most important thing for me, when I looked at the data of the results that Peter was going over, there is a concerning thing here, and that's the difference in measures of PaO2 less than 60 at least once in patients who were assigned either the conservative or liberal strategy. In the conservative group, 43% of patients had at least one hypoxic value compared to just 27% of patients. That's not an insignificant number from a clinical standpoint, right? When we're thinking about what this trial was designed to do, that significant of hypoxia in a brain injured patient is not clinically insignificant. Now, we may not have seen that in the outcomes, but as we say, anytime we go through these trials, it's really difficult for any of these one interventions to affect mortality, but this could affect affected brain injury, and there's really no way to tell that from the results that were reported. But at the bedside, what that means to me is I'm probably going to lean more towards that liberal group of maybe slightly higher and not down titrate my FiO2 rapidly because that appears to increase the risk the patient might have at least clinically significant hypoxia. Lastly, with regards to the mortality and other outcomes in this trial, it's a little bit difficult to interpret when it falls within the window of withdrawal of life-sustaining therapies. And we know that this is a conflator of outcomes in cardiac arrest trials because these patients are not allowed to get to their biologic endpoint. There are family decisions that are made and clinical decisions that are made independent of what the trial prescribes that affect the outcome. So I don't know how to interpret that. You would say, well, it's a randomized trial, so you assume they're similar between each group. So that's fine. But if we're trying to get to the idea of, well, how did this intervention affect neurologic outcome? In an ideal world, we let allow this patient to live until their biologic endpoint of death, but that's not going to happen realistically. So, I think it's just worth considering, and anyone who's considering doing research in cardiac arrest has to deal with withdrawal of life-sustaining therapies decisions. But just to nail the point home that I was making before, hypoxia is real, especially if you're targeting conservative therapy, and don't ignore it. If you're gonna check blood gases or whatever, check them regularly as you're down titrating. Don't just down titrate and walk away.
Outstanding comments, all three of you, really. And that's why I love going through these papers, the deep dissection and how we bring it back to the bedside. Let me ask, just as a final question and some summary points. With that, John, and knowing just say national guidelines, roughly keep it nine saturations 92 to 97%. Is that a fair range? Are you in a little bit tighter, 95 to 97%? I'd ask you that, and then we'll go to Peter and then Rob.
If I'm being completely honest, I do err on the side of staying 94 to 98%, a little bit higher, just to give myself some wiggle room on the downside. We know that these patients after rest, they can develop pulmonary edema. It's a dynamic therapeutic time early on. I don't want to get myself to the floor and put myself at risk for a significant hypoxemic event. Maybe it's from mucus plugging or something like that. So I do tend to lean a little bit towards the higher range, but I'm still practicing what ILCOR and AHA guidance is recommending, which is normoxia. I'm just avoiding the extremes.
Peter.
I shoot with John on this in a similar fashion. My goal is 94 to 98%. I don't try and, wiggle it down to 90% to 92%. Kind of range. I consider that normoxia, right?
Well said. Now, Rob, final comment. Bring us home.
I used to try to keep it to 90 to 94. Because my inclination was that less might be a little bit better. And my fear was the other direction in terms of hyperoxia. But now, I don't know. This study may change my practice. I may titrate a little bit higher.
All right. Well, thanks to the three of you. Really, really wonderful discussion on a hot topic, a paper hot off the press, and really am grateful for us going through this for all of our listeners. If any of you have any questions, once we get this posted, please shoot us any emails, whether that's to our personal accounts or through the website. Love continuing these conversations after each of these posts. And thanks to everybody who took the time to listen to this podcast. Super excited to have you as listeners, and really, we're looking forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.